From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
How do we remove the face of poverty from our world?
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Americans who care about women's reproductive health and decision-making should be concerned about Judge Roberts' nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think that we really ought to go ahead and do it.
This is a giant theater piece designed to convince the world that Israel is taking steps towards peace.
And if I have to stay out here all month in this heat, it's not anything compared to what our soldiers are going through.
Today, power, politics, and resistance, a look back at 2005. A Democracy Now! New Year's special. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, part two of our look back at 2005, the stories and struggles that shape the world.
The decisions of the Supreme Court affect the life of every American. And so a nominee to that court must be a person of superb credentials and the highest integrity. I have found such a person in Judge John Roberts.
Now, he has no memory of ever joining or paying dues to the Federalist Society. He has no recollection of that. He has participated in events and panel discussions. He's given speeches at Federalist Society forums, but he doesn't have any recollection of ever paying dues or joining the organization.
Roberts, whether he's paid his dues or not, was prominently listed in the 1997-1998 leadership directory published by the Federalist Society itself. So it's very difficult to believe that he didn't have any membership. He was on the steering committee. The important question is not whether he paid dues as a member or not. The question really at stake here is where does Roberts and his Federalist Society cronies plan to steer our ship of state? If one looks at the history of the Federalist Society, which was established at the inspiration of Robert Bork in the early 80s, their entire trajectory has been to move our judicial system in an extremely radically right-wing direction.
Well, Americans who care about women's reproductive health and decision-making should be concerned about Judge Roberts' nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. As you talked about before, he has, in his legal career, advocated for the reversal of Roe versus Wade.
From 1981 to 1993, the Reagan and Bush administrations did everything possible to turn back the clock on civil rights protections for women, for minorities, for people with disabilities, and older Americans. It looks more and more with every passing day and with every passing revelation that John Roberts was at the epicenter of all these efforts during the 1980s and early 1990s. The American people have a right to know precisely what his role was.
John Roberts' positions, though consistent with the Reagan administration, do raise questions at this time about how he would interpret the Voting Rights Act as it sits today.
I call on the world community to be bold, to adhere to the Kyoto Protocol, and to act quickly in taking the next steps. There is no time to lose.
In Kyoto, Japan, rallies are being held to mark the anti-global warming treaty known as the Kyoto Protocol that officially goes into effect today. The global treaty aims to slow the rate of global warming by forcing nations to reduce carbon emissions. 141 countries have signed the treaty, but several key nations have refused to sign it, including the United States.
Kyoto is in many ways unrealistic. Many countries cannot meet their Kyoto targets. The targets themselves were arbitrary and not based upon science.
Yesterday, the New York Times reported a White House official who once led the oil industry's fight against limits on greenhouse gases repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that play down links between such emissions and global warming.
Essentially, scientists from a dozen agencies and other officials from another dozen agencies spent months on these reports coming up with language that they thought framed the issues correctly as far as the science goes. So when they put in a line that said the Earth is experiencing significant significant change, environmental change right now, that they meant that. It's a real thing. It's a pretty unassailable fact. And in that instance, he changed the word is to maybe.
In Niger, 3.3 million people, including almost a million children, are facing starvation after a drought and locusts wiped out last year's harvest.
We have a full-blown emergency in Niger. Children are dying from hunger. It was all predictable. And only now, these days in mid-July, when the images come on television of dying, starving children, do we receive the funding we need.
In a few days' time, the leaders of the G8 nations will meet in Scotland. They will face perhaps the most critical question that our world has had to face. How do we remove the face of poverty from our world?
In the wake of the concerts calling on the world's richest countries to make poverty history, the Group of Eight Nations begins its three-day summit Wednesday in Gleneagles, Scotland.
Things have been made worse by the summit, but the commitments which they gave in their rhetoric, none of them have been met.
The Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
A series of bomb blasts ripped through the London subway system during rush hour this morning. As many as seven separate blasts have been reported. At least one double-decker bus was also reportedly blown up, with witnesses describing it like a can of sardines being ripped open.
They just peeled a big hole off the top of the roof, and there were bits of the train scattered all over the tracks. You know, dead bodies lay by the side of the tracks.
People started saying prayers, praying to God, panicking, breaking the carriage windows with bare hands.
Here at the summit, the world's leaders are striving to combat world poverty and save and improve human life. The perpetrators of today's attacks are intent on destroying human life.
But it would be entirely dishonest to pretend that this came out of nowhere. Inexcusable, but not inexplicable. Sadly, all too explicable and explained even before we did it by the anti-war movement. We said this would not make the world a safer place, it would make the world a more dangerous place.
The family of Jean-Charles de Menezes, the 27-year-old Brazilian man shot and killed Friday by London police investigating the bombings, may sue over his death.
And the fear amongst the minority communities, such as Muslims, is the fear of reprisal. Many mosques have been attacked. Many individuals have been attacked. One person was beaten to death.
Yesterday, a massive car bombing in Baghdad killed 27 people, almost all children. An American soldier was also killed in the blast. Elsewhere in Baghdad, another dozen Sunni Muslims were found dead after being arrested by Iraqi police over the weekend. Meanwhile, a new study from an Iraqi humanitarian organization is estimating 128,000 Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded in March 2003, over half of them women and children. And Iraq's Interior Ministry told the New York Times today over 8,000 civilians have been killed in insurgent attacks between August and May. We're joined right now by independent journalist Dar Jamal.
The situation in London, four bombings, four bombs, and so many civilians killed, that's become
almost an average day in Iraq. And yet we look at the disparity of the coverage, which this incident is really telling in the disparity that's ongoing with this, where so many civilians every single day in Iraq are being killed, the infrastructure in shambles, the country on fire, and where is the coverage? It's becoming more and more difficult as time goes on to even find it.
The most striking feature of the last year is that things have got progressively worse. Most of Iraq is really a bloody no man's land now. The transfer of power last year ago to the interim Iraqi government, which was billed as a great turning point, turned out to be no such thing. It's one of a series of turning points that have been presented, such as the capture of Saddam Hussein, the transfer of power, the capture of Fallujah last year, the elections. And Iraqis have seen their lives get worse and worse over that period. And there's no reason that anything should get any better.
We go directly to Baghdad right now to speak with feminist Yanar Mohammed. She and other women protested on Sunday in central Baghdad, saying that they feared lawmakers would approve a, quote, fascist, nationalist, and Islamist constitution that would strip women of many of their rights.
All our fears have been realized. Islam will be the main source of legislation. In other words, women have turned into second-rate citizens.
Women's rights in Iraq under Hussein had been some of the best, certainly in the Middle East, and had been guaranteed, as I said, under the Hussein-era constitution. Now much of that is very much up in play as the negotiations seem to have be putting significantly more attention onto Islamic law. There is, however, a very powerful women's rights movement in Iraq that is fighting very aggressively to stem that tide.
We warn you, some of the images we'll be showing right now are extremely graphic. On Saturday, hundreds of Haitians gathered for the funeral of Emmanuel Dread Wilme, a community leader who lives in Cité Soleil, one of the most economically depressed neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. Wilme was killed last Wednesday when UN troops attacked Cité Soleil in a pre-dawn raid. Although the raid has received little attention, local residents say it might have been the deadliest attack carried out by UN troops since they've been stationed in Haiti last year. According to the residents, the UN troops entered the area about 3 in the morning and opened fire. Eyewitnesses report the UN troops used helicopters, tanks, machine guns, tear gas in the operation.
A lot of innocent civilians were killed. And there are even some people that they kill and just take them with them. One of the worst things that happened is that they killed like a mom with two of her children, and they seal the bodies are sealed there.
What we found actually when we went into the community the day after the operation was widespread evidence that the troops had carried out a massacre. We found homes, which when we say homes, we're talking basically shacks of wood and tin in many cases, riddled with machine gun blasts as well as tank fire. The holes in a lot of these homes were too large just to be bullets.
Today, Haiti's first democratically elected leader, Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, lives in forced exile in South Africa. He was overthrown a year and a half ago in what he calls a, quote, modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States.
Our guest is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He is the former chief of staff of Colin Powell, a secretary of state. He served as his chief of staff from 2002 to 2005.
Aristide was the person who needed to be removed from Haiti, and even he understood that. In the conversation he had with our ambassador, he understood that. He knew that he was the lightning rod, and that if he didn't remove himself from the island, there was going to be a lot of bloodshed.
This was not the overall sentiment of the Haitian people, and he said it was the U.S. that pressed him to leave, that pushed him out, that put him onto this plane with a U.S. military and security. He had no idea where he was going until he was dumped in the Central African Republic.
I can't imagine a man like Aristide, whose will to power is excessive, even obsessive, saying anything differently.
Meanwhile, Haitian priest Gerard Jean-Just, a leader of Aristide's Lavalas party, was arrested last week and charged with the assassination of journalist Jacques Roche, even though he was in Miami at the time of the murder. Father Jean-Just is now being held incommunicado. Amnesty International has announced it considers him a prisoner of conscience.
Well, we had the opportunity this week to visit him twice, once on Tuesday and, Tuesday and then again yesterday. He is still very spiritually strong and very committed and determined to continue the struggle for justice and democracy. But he, based on my previous visits with him, is very physically weak and sick. He's in a lot of pain and clearly fatigued.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2005 is to be shared in two equal parts between the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and its Director General, Mohamed El-Baradei.
We're really shocked because the Atomic Agency has been responsible for over 50 years to promote the spread of nuclear technology. And this is the cause of the spread of nuclear weapons.
We executed our turn away as we had been directed. The bomb blast hit us. It hit us in two different shock waves, the first being the stronger.
This weekend marks the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there are commemorations being held in Japan and many other countries around the world, including here in the United States.
On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, Nagasaki was hit. Over 200,000 people died in the atomic bombings of the cities. Joining us in our studio today, here in New York, is the mayor of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba.
I hope that the United States will start in a heeding to the majority opinion of the Americans. In a recent poll, 66% of Americans felt that no nations should have nuclear weapons for the safety of the world. And therefore, as a democratic country, if the government, starts listening to this voice and to the rest of the world, which overwhelmingly want nuclear weapons eliminated, I think that the world would be a much safer place and happier place.
爆心地から約1キロメートルの広島市役所の付近で被爆しました。
When the atomic bomb was dropped, I was near the Hiroshima City Hall, about 1 kilometer away from the Ground Zero.
その時の状況は血だらけになった被爆者、黒焦げになって死んでいる人たちなどなどたくさんの人がこの世の地獄でありました。
I've seen so many hibakusha wounded, injured, and killed in blood and in burns. It was like hell on earth.
現在の病名は再生不良貧血症、狭心症、大腸癌、前立腺癌等であります。
After so many years, I've survived, but I have many, many illnesses. Aplastic anemia, angina, colon cancer, prostate cancer.
No more Hiroshima. No more Nagasaki. No more Hibakusha.
No more Hibakusha.
No more who?
What are you good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Uh-huh.
What?
In Washington, D.C., between 1 and 300,000 gathered for the city's largest anti-war demonstration since the Vietnam War. Thousands more marched in London, Copenhagen, Damascus, Helsinki, Paris, Rome, Seoul, Toronto, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other cities and towns. This is the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
The Nuremberg judgment calls the war of aggression the supreme international crime.
But just as sure as an ill wind now blows, it doesn't have to be so. The people united can stop wars. We can stop injustice and we can stop indifference. The people united can tear down the mightiest walls of oppression. These ill winds have brought us high crimes and more than misdemeanors.
This is Democracy Now! Power, Politics, and Resistance in 2005. Stay with us.
Let's make heaven tonight.
I used to think about infinity and how my memory is finna be invisibly slim in that vicinity. Although the stars are magnificent, whiskey in the midnight sky can make you feel insignificant. The revolution in this tuning verse is a bid for my love to touch the universe. Struggling over wages and fun, so let the movement get contagious and run through the end when it's dangerous and guns. And if we win in the ages to come, we'll have a chapter where the history pages are from. They won't never know our name or face, but fill our soul in free food they taste. Feel our passion when they heat their house, when they got power on the street and the police don't beat them about. Let's make healthcare centers on every block. Let's give everybody home to the garden plot. Let's give all the schools books, 10 kids a glass. Give them truth for their pencils and pads. Retail clerk, love balance where you place this on. Let's make heaven right here just in case they wrong.
Your man wanna save my soul.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, our New Year's special, Power, Politics, and Resistance in 2005. A new United Nations report on Sudan criticizes the government and its militia of systematically abusing and killing civilians in the country's western Darfur region. But the report concludes the Sudanese government did not pursue a policy of genocide.
The government and its Janjaweed auxiliaries are responsible for an appalling series of crimes against civilians in Darfur. These people were being raped, robbed, driven out of their homes, killed in a number of cases, as you say. And even when the Ware rebels, the use of force was totally disproportionate. So they say this probably amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
We have to reject the conclusion of the report with regard to the issue of genocide. This is genocide. That's why it's important that you call it what it is. Otherwise, there's no point in having an international convention on genocide. There's no point in saying never again, as we did at the 60th anniversary of the Holocaust or the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide.
On Monday, the funeral for African-American publisher and entrepreneur John H. Johnson was held in Chicago. Johnson died last week at the age of 87. He was widely regarded as the most influential African-American publisher in American history and a pioneer in media and business.
I do not consider him to be the greatest black publisher in the history of our industry. I consider him to be one of the greatest publishers. I think if there was a Mount Rushmore of the media magnates, I believe that John H. Johnson's bust would be alongside Henry Luce, David Sarnoff, Bill Paley, Ted Turner, and the other icons of our industry.
The Israeli pullout from the Gaza Strip began officially today. Gaza is currently home to 8,500 Israeli settlers and 1.4 million Palestinians.
No matter what happened, we not leave this place because it's our country. We can't give it to our enemies. So we're going to stay here and fight.
We want for the settlers and the army to leave in peace and security without any undue incidents.
Thousands of soldiers are deploying today to inform residents of the 21 Gaza settlements and four of 120 West Bank settlements that they have 2 days to move out voluntarily.
And this whole process of expulsion of Jews from communities in the land of Israel implies that there are places in this world where Jews are not allowed to live.
This is a giant theater piece designed to convince the world that Israel is taking steps towards peace, that it's making enormous sacrifices. I have no doubt that there are settlers who genuinely don't wish to leave Gaza, and let's remember they've been put there by the Israeli government. The extremist ideology, the really hate-filled ideology that we heard the settler expressing earlier in the show, has been encouraged and incited for decades by the Israeli government.
ABC News anchor Peter Jennings has died at the age of 67. He led the network's nightly newscast from 1983 until April. On April 5th, he confirmed on his show that he'd been diagnosed with lung cancer.
I wonder if other men and women ask their doctors right away, okay, doc, when does the hair go? At any rate, that's it for now in World News Tonight. Have a good evening. I'm Peter Jennings. Thanks and good night.
None of the coverage I've seen really talked about the fact that he was killed by the tobacco industry and that he died a very premature and quite horrible death because he was addicted to nicotine.
What's wrong with cutting and running? That's the question asked by retired Army General William Odom about the continued U.S. military presence in Iraq.
In war, as well as in politics and diplomacy, one has to know when to withdraw and when to attack. And this was a misguided attack, and it requires a strategic vision and the moral confidence to turn it around. The earlier the better, but as the evidence piles up, I think my judgment is being borne out.
An immediate withdrawal of our troops in Iraq or the broader Middle East, as some have called for, would only embolden the terrorists.
We turn now to the story of Cindy Sheehan. A year and a half ago, Sheehan's oldest son, Casey, was killed in Iraq. He was 24 years old. Sheehan is now in Crawford, Texas, taking part in a vigil near President Bush's vacation ranch. She has asked for a meeting with the president, but so far the White House has said no.
He doesn't have any children in harm's way. You know, if there's more soldiers or Marines killed today, he won't have to worry if one of them is his daughter, you know, because he's insulated, he's safe. Nobody in this administration or Congress has to worry about their children. And if I have to stay out here all month in this heat, it's not anything compared to what our soldiers are going through and what the people of Iraq are going through.
Listen, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan. She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We are broadcasting on location in Crawford, Texas, outside President Bush's ranch. We're here at Camp Casey.
It's quite remarkable. You're almost setting up field operations, but field operations for peace, not war.
I had to be here. I had to support Cindy. I had to support the mothers. I came because what she started is very important. I think it's going to make history.
Whatever his reasons that he feel it was for my son to die and all the rest of the troop to die and to be out there, that's not the point anymore. Although against that, all he can do is redeem himself by bringing the troop home.
Matthew Scott Laurie would have been 42 this last July 28th. He was a true American hero. He did not have to go back the second time, but he knew that he was needed to protect his troops.
I want to know why I was sent into an unnecessary war without body armor and in an unarmored Humvee. I want to know why there wasn't even enough ammunition for me to protect myself.
My son is going to Iraq based on lies, and
It's very clear. I wanted to believe, and my son wanted to believe, too. But nothing has come forward, nothing, to show any of us mothers that our sons are going there to fight for a noble cause.
All of us mothers have a certain code that we go by, and that is that our children are first, okay? Our children come first. And when they're harmed based on a war that's based on lies, we're going to be angry. And that's what Cindy is here to ask the president, at least answer her question. Now, why is it that the president can't come out and answer her question?
I believe that this is a poor man's war. They have solicited the minorities to go in, and if you look at all the rates and you look at all statistics, you've had more minorities die in this war than you've had anything else.
And if we leave August 31st without the president speaking to us, it's going to keep on. It's growing. It's organic. It's here, and nothing's going to stop it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish I had better news for you, but we are facing a storm that most of us have feared. Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans, or, if no other alternative is available, to immediately move to one of the facilities within the city that will be designated as a refuge of last resort.
And the Gulf Coast region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. At least 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The city has no electricity and little drinkable water. Officials say New Orleans will be uninhabitable for weeks. On Tuesday, two levees broke, flooding areas of the city that appeared to survive the storm.
This is a national disaster. Get every doggone Greyhound bus line in the country and get their asses moving to New Orleans. That's they thinking small, man, and this is a major, major, major deal.
Talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind. And those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like. And the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
Help! 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 Help!
There are throngs of people, easily in the tens of thousands, maybe 40 to 50,000 people, in my estimation, standing on this plaza trying to get to a very narrow area where they're being escorted to the buses. I haven't seen one bus leave yet.
Please, babe. 6 and 8 months. The people just walking past us.
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
They got the food right here. Let me show you right here. All of it. Look, right here. Look. They won't give us nothing. Nothing.
Open the gate right there.
Look. They won't give us nothing. We ain't drinking no ice water, nothing.
This is not about low income. It's not about rich people, poor people. It's about people. Nobody wants to hurt anybody in this city. Nobody wants to hurt these people who have these businesses. And they want a little air and a little food and water, for God's sake. That's it.
There's nobody in charge. The National Guard. There's the police. There is nobody. Somebody needs to come take charge and put organization and get these people to safety, to get them clothes, the basic things that they need to live from day to day.
Well, we've been people being killed down here. People were telling me their bodies were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the little military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here.
Federal relief officials have played almost no role. The head of FEMA, Michael Brown, admitted on CNN last night his agency didn't even know that thousands of hungry refugees were inside the convention center. Residents continue to break into stores in search of everything from food and water to guns to luxury items.
Nobody here but us, and we just got to look out for one another. All your politicians, they want to get on TV, talking about feeding this person, feeding that person. We ain't seen nothing over there yet.
The White House announced it would have zero tolerance for looters, even for those taking essential items needed to stay alive.
Well, I want zero tolerance for that kind of language being used by leaders of our government to discuss poor people, poor black people who are trying to survive under the most desperate, insane circumstances. I want zero tolerance for thousands of our troops being sent to Iraq when we need them here.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food. George Bush doesn't care about black people.
In Biloxi, Mississippi, the first federal aid arrived only yesterday, 3 full days after the storm wiped out entire sections of the city. In smaller towns in Mississippi, help has still not arrived.
We left for the hurricane and came back Monday night hoping that we could help some people because, I don't know, looking at the response to this storm, particularly initially, there wasn't a lot of outside help, so we decided that really it was up to the people of Jefferson Parish to take the parish back.
What I saw from the federal government was a grand total of 3 boats, Border Patrol agents on 3 boats, 2 airboats and 1 flat-bottom boat. And I saw far more of a response from citizens who had just taken it upon themselves to go and pluck people out of their homes, and they plucked about a dozen out on Saturday.
We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taken place is taken place by volunteers and citizens in the area. Why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here? Why is it just volunteers? That's the only people you see around.
FEMA Director Mike Brown is in charge of all federal response and recovery efforts in the field.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi has called for your resignation, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
The president's in charge of that, not me.
Well, right at the top, you have Michael Brown, and as you mentioned, he was the commissioner of judges at the International Arabian Horse Association. To give you an idea of what he did there, he spent a year investigating whether a breeder performed liposuction on a horse's rear end.
This is an attempt by some in this room to engage in finger-pointing and blame game, and I'm just not going to do that.
Christian televangelist Pat Robertson set off an international firestorm this week when he called for the assassination of Venezuela's democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez.
We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-armed dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Mr. Robertson calls that U.S. government covert operative murder President Hugo Chavez is a call to terrorism.
He has destroyed the Venezuelan economy, and he's going to make that a launching pad for communist infiltration and Muslim extremism all over the continent.
Robertson, along with most of the radical Christian right, endorses violence as a kind of curative for the satanic movement, secular humanism, liberalism, Islam, whatever it is that they see outside the gate.
We have the ability to take him out, and I think the time has come that we exercise that ability.
And televangelist Pat Robertson, his call for your assassination, what do you demand now, and what is your response to that?
Robertson, no Robertson.
Well, as a matter of fact, Robertson is not acting alone.
Robertson expresó.
He's just conveying,
de manera hasta desesperada,
in a perhaps desperate manner,
la voz de los círculos más,
the thinking of those people closer to Mr. Bush.
Esa es la voz de los más radicales.
This is the voice of the most radical of the extreme right wing in the U.S.
This is Democracy Now!'s New Year's special, part 2 of Power, Politics, and Resistance. Stay with us.
Jimmy joined the army because he had no place to go. Can they learn himself a trade, maybe see the world? Move to the city someday, marry a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere under the plan, a nice got a rifle in his hand. He's rolling in the Baghdad, wondering how he got this this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, community and college stations, as well as PBS and public access TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our New Year's special, Power, Politics, and Resistance in 2005.
A Texas grand jury on Wednesday indicted House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and two political associates on charges of conspiracy in a campaign finance scheme.
It's a charge that cannot hold up even under the most glancing scrutiny. This act is the product of a coordinated, premeditated campaign of political retribution, the all too predictable result of a vengeful investigation led by a partisan fanatic.
But this is the first time in over a century, I think, that a leader in the Congress has been, a sitting leader in the Congress has been indicted. And the fact that he had to step down is nothing short of extraordinary.
Last week, it was disclosed that Senate Majority Leader Dr. Bill Frist was under federal investigation for a stock sale.
The government case against HCA was basically that the Frist family company kept two sets of books and fraudulently overbilled the government.
A U.S. district judge ordered New York Times reporter Judith Miller jailed yesterday for refusing to reveal her confidential sources to a special prosecutor investigating who in the Bush administration leaked a covert CIA officer's identity.
Wow.
Do you have any comment at all?
I'm sorry, I can't.
For the first time in 130 years, a White House staff member has been indicted for crimes committed in office. On Friday, Louis Libby was indicted on 5 counts of obstruction of justice, perjury to a grand jury, and making false statements to FBI agents during the CIA leak investigation. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald announced the indictment Friday afternoon.
He was just passing gossip from one reporter to another at the long end of a chain of phone calls. It would be a compelling story that would lead the FBI to go away, if only it were true. It is not true, according to the indictment.
On Sunday, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called on Karl Rove to resign.
Well, at a minimum, for if Bush was serious about protecting this nation's security, he should turn to Karl Rove and ask for his resignation. His clearances should be pulled, because there's no doubt now that he was involved with helping pass the name and mishandle classified information.
With the eyes of the nation firmly focused on the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, there have been major developments in the battle over the future of the Supreme Court. On Saturday, the ailing Chief Justice William Rehnquist passed away. He'll be buried on Wednesday. His death leaves a powerful vacancy at the helm of one of the three branches of government. President Bush moved quickly in naming his desired replacement for Rehnquist, Judge John Roberts, the man Bush had already selected to fill Sandra Day O'Connor's seat.
This morning, I'm proud to announce that I'm nominating Harriet Ellen Myers to serve as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
I believe the senators of both parties will find that Harriet Myers' talent, experience, and judicial philosophy make her a superb choice to safeguard the constitutional liberties and equality of all Americans.
If confirmed, I recognize that I will have a tremendous responsibility to keep our judicial system strong.
I'm sorry to hear that Ms. Myers has decided to remove her name from consideration. The way Harriet Myers has been treated as really disgraceful.
I've never seen anything like this. This has been an astonishing spectacle. The president was attacked from within his own base, and he was pounded day after day, as was Harriet Myers. He basically surrendered. It was an abject, total capitulation to the right-wing special interest group.
If you go to a war, you realize that it is not primarily about victory or defeat. It is about death and the infliction of death and suffering on as large a scale as you can make it. It is about the total failure of the human spirit. But we don't show that because we don't want to. And in this sense, journalists, television reporting, television cameras are lethal. They collude with governments to allow you to have more wars, because if they showed you the truth, you wouldn't allow any more wars.
How many Iraqi citizens have died in this war? I would say 30,000, more or less, have died as a result of the initial incursion and the ongoing violence against Iraqis.
Last year, the prominent British medical journal Lancet published a study estimating that over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died because of the war. The study determined that the risk of death by violence for civilians in Iraq is now 58 times higher than before the U.S. invasion.
I know the mortuary officials well enough for them to trust me by showing me the screen figures. And in July, it is a fact that 1,100 Iraqis died by violence in just July. I was there in August, and one Monday morning, there were 9 bodies brought to the mortuary, death by violence by 9 a.m. At 12 o'clock, there were 26, including a young woman who was brought in with her hands tied behind her back, shot 3 times in the brain, and a baby shot in the face. These are real figures. These are real people. This is not extrapolation. This is the reality.
Civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks has died at the age of 92. It was 50 years ago this December that she refused to relinquish her seat to a white man aboard a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Rosa Parks was arrested and convicted of violating the state's segregation laws.
I remember my father telling me about this colored woman who had refused to give up her seat. And in my child's mind, I thought, she must be really big.
Her legacy is secure. Her work unfinished. I came into Detroit last night. 75,000 Negroes walking in the cold to see her body. If they don't vote on Tuesday, they wasted her time.
She became such an icon in American history and popular culture that the Neville brothers immortalized her. They sang, "Thank you, Miss Rosa."
Thank you, Miss Rosa. You are the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks.
Rescue efforts continue halfway around the globe in Guatemala, where mudslides have buried towns in up to 20 feet of mud. More than 650 people are confirmed dead, 1,400 still listed missing and believed to have been buried alive. The government is considering declaring certain areas to be mass grave.
The people are facing a natural disaster right now, but for decades they faced a human-made tragedy. And the military's responsibility in, hundreds of massacres, hundreds of thousands of deaths, and a genocide in that country creates, obviously, a mistrust and a very, very poor image, to say the least.
The death toll from Saturday's massive earthquake in South Asia has topped 42,000. 10,000 people are believed to have died in the capital of the Pakistani-controlled Kashmir. United Nations estimates 2.5 million people have been left homeless. About 1,000 hospitals have been completely destroyed.
But nobody has any idea what has happened in the more remote villages. Even in the best of times, I mean, these are areas that we've been, trekking through. There are very few jeep tracks. These are fairly inaccessible areas. and whole villages, you know, have been apparently been, you know, wiped out because of landslides and mudslides.
You know, what's shocking is that people couldn't be rescued from villages and remote places, or Muzaffarabad and Balakot as well, where the roads were cut off and the only way to reach them was by helicopter. And the country's president, General Musharraf, was saying, we don't have enough helicopters, but in neighboring Afghanistan, there's a whole fleet of bloody helicopters which could have been diverted to help people in need rather than being used for purposes of war.
We turn now to the case of death row prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams. In just under 2 weeks, on December 13th, the 51-year-old Williams is scheduled to be executed by the state of California. Williams is a convicted murderer, co-founder of one of the country's most notorious street gangs, the Crips. But since his incarceration, he's also become a Nobel Peace Prize-nominated children's author and a vocal advocate against gang violence. Stanley Tookie Williams' life now largely rests in the hands of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has the power to commute the death sentence.
Being a Crip was all I knew. I thought there was nothing else. I dreaded life after Cripping. I dreaded that. But I say to any individual who's in a gang that if you have enough courage to get into a gang, you should have equally enough or even more to get out of it.
He was executed by lethal injection shortly after midnight. He was pronounced dead at 0035 military time.
There was nothing there that made me go against the will of the people.
They yelled, the state of California just killed an innocent man, which is the first time I've ever heard any outburst in the death chamber.
We know that Al Jazeera has a pattern of playing propaganda over and over.
The British government has threatened to use the Official Secrets Act to sue newspapers that publish contents of a leaked memo in which President Bush allegedly discusses bombing the Arabic satellite network Al Jazeera.
Even if I begin to agree or accept any allegation against Al Jazeera, which I totally refute, I certainly, no decent human being on earth would even begin to justify murdering journalists.
The point here is that the United States, in all of the journalists, and there are at least 13 that have been killed by the United States in Iraq, they either rule it a justified killing or they rule it a mistake. And there is a lot of information to indicate that these are not mistakes.
Mr. President, recently Amnesty International said you have established, quote, a new gulag of prisons around the world beyond the reach of the law and decency.
Yeah. I'm aware of the Amnesty International report, and it's absurd. It's an absurd allegation.
Abu Ghraib was just the tip of the iceberg. The mistreatment of Muslim prisoners has been widespread in three countries at these so-called secret locations where the CIA is holding suspected al-Qaeda leaders, as well as in the dungeons of third countries to which the United States has rendered detainees.
At the request of U.S. officials, the Washington Post did not disclose the location of the Eastern European prison.
But the Post obviously capitulated to kind of suspect arguments by very high U.S. Officials.
And it's interesting that this debate comes back to Vice President Cheney, because, in fact, from all we've seen so far, people focus on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld as the source of torture policy within the administration. That's not really correct.
We were using dogs in the Mosul detention facility, which was at the Mosul airport. We would put the prisoner in a shipping container. We would keep him up all night with music and strobe lights, stress positions, and then we would bring in dogs.
We have not seen anything like this before, as absolutely breathtaking, audacious, unlawful kidnapping of vast numbers of people.
Today marks the one-year anniversary of the U.S. assault on the Sunni city of Fallujah. U.S. and Iraqi military forced out the town's residents, bombed hospitals and buildings, attacked whole neighborhoods, and denied entry to relief workers. 10,000 buildings were destroyed, thousands more seriously damaged. This is Dar Jamal speaking on Democracy Now! Just under a year ago.
I have interviewed many refugees over the last week coming out of Fallujah at different times from different locations within the city. The consistent stories that I've been getting have been refugees describing phosphorus weapons, horribly burned bodies, fires that burn on people when they touch these weapons, and they're unable to extinguish the fires even after dumping large amounts of water on the people.
I know of no cases where people were deliberately targeted by the use of white phosphorus.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan speaking on Democracy Now! Last Tuesday. But the Pentagon was caught in a lie after it was revealed that an official Army publication called Field Artillery Magazine had disclosed the Army had in fact used white phosphorus as a weapon. The magazine in its March-April issue reported, quote, "We fired shake-and-bake missions at the insurgents using WP, white phosphorus, to flush them out, and HE, high explosives, to take them out." On Tuesday, Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, another Pentagon spokesperson, admitted on the BBC that white phosphorus was used as an offensive weapon to target insurgents.
And may be used against enemy combatants.
Can you confirm then that it was used as an offensive weapon against enemy troops during the siege of Fallujah?
Yes. It was used as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants.
President Bush has admitted he secretly ordered the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans without ever seeking constitutionally required court-approved warrants. The president initially refused to answer any questions about the secret program, but on Saturday he spoke openly about it and defended the practice.
I authorized the National Security Agency, consistent with U.S. law and the Constitution, to intercept the international communications of people with known links to Al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations.
And this warrantless eavesdropping program is not authorized by the Patriot Act. It's not authorized by any act of Congress, and it's not overseen by any court. And according to the reports, it's being conducted under a secret presidential order based on secret legal opinions by the same Justice Department lawyers, the same ones who argued secretly that the president could order the use of torture. Mr. President, it is time to have some checks and balances in this country. We are a democracy. We are a democracy. Let's have checks and balances, not secret orders and secret courts and secret torture and on and on.
The I word has returned to Washington. Well, 7 years ago, after the House of Representatives impeached President Clinton, we are in the week anniversary. Discussion of the possible impeachment of President Bush has reached a new high.
On the closing hours of the session over the weekend, I introduced House Resolution 635, which creates a select committee to investigate the administration's intent to go to war before they received congressional authorization and manipulation of pre-war intelligence and encouraging and countenancing torture of detainees and retaliating against critics, and to make recommendations regarding possible grounds for impeachment.
That does it for our year in review, Power, Politics, and Resistance in 2005. If you'd like to get a copy of both parts of our year in review, you can go to our website and get a DVD at democracynow.org, or just see and hear the images and voices of this past year. Today's broadcast was edited by John Hamilton, with help from Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Robbie Karen, Jenny Jo Utz, and Jury Leon Zakari. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadu, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anna Noguera, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser, and Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Tyshawn Black, Jerome Bourgeois, Peter Yoon, Samantha Chambly, Neil Shabata, Isis Phillips, Jenny Filippazzo, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, Ting Ting Chen, Tamiko Beyer, Chris Zucker, Rebecca Silver, Orlando Richards, Nick Marsilio, Jeremy Scahill, Susie Salami, Mike Castleman, Danielle Ferris, and Juan Gonzalez. Again, our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. To all of you from all of us.